from 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hillary Clinton maintains a slim lead over Donald Trump in Pennsylvania heading into their second debate.
Who loses money running a casino besides Donald Trump?
She's been a disaster. Everything she's done has been bad.
We'll examine Hillary Clinton's and Donald Trump's efforts to sway voters in this swing state. Members of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra remain on strike, the first walkout in 41 years.
Management refuses to meet with us right now, so we don't know how we're even going to get to an agreement.
Management says a big deficit is looming. The union says quality players could leave Pittsburgh. We'll also examine the city's plans to repair malfunctioning gates in a flood-prone area. That's all ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. Our weekly reporters roundup. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the first time since 1975, the Pittsburgh Symphony has gone quiet as musicians have gone on strike after failing to reach a contract agreement with management. But first, on The Confluence, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump campaign in Pennsylvania this week.
Pennsylvania Steel and the incredible steelworkers will send new skyscrapers into the clouds. American hands will rebuild this nation.
If you look at his business record, which is his main claim to be president of the United States, right? He says he wants to do for America what he did for business.
Joining us to discuss the candidate strategies in Pennsylvania, Tom Fontaine, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks for having me on.
And Katie Meyer, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and the other public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Welcome, Katie.
Hello.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us at WESA Confluence. So to both of you, have the messages from each candidate when campaigning in Pennsylvania remained the same over the last weeks, months, or have you noticed anything different, more emphasis on a particular issue? We'll start with you, Katie.
Sure. So, I think to a certain extent they've been pretty consistent. You've seen from the beginning both candidates, I'd say Donald Trump a little bit more, stressing that manufacturing jobs have, dwindled in Pennsylvania, especially, steel and coal. And he's been, again, pushing to bring those back, to protect the miners, we're going to start making things again, folks, is his line that he uses all the time. Hillary Clinton has acknowledged, the loss of manufacturing. Again, and this has been a decades-long slide into less manufacturing in the state, obviously. But Clinton has a different approach where she's saying we need to bring back, we need to train people for trades. We need to bring tech in as, a middle-class job. So there are, they're acknowledging the same issues, but different ways of dealing with them. And there's been other messaging that's been pretty consistent throughout the campaign as well.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think the thing that Hillary Clinton and her campaign have really tried to stress, particularly in recent weeks, and this could be troubling for Donald Trump, is, his Make America Great Again slogan. They of course, throughout the campaign have focused on many of the products in his own business, are made overseas. And so now there are these troubling reports. He's talked a lot about breathing new life into the steel industry, that some of his buildings, his hotels are made with foreign-made steel and that they've avoided tariffs in getting that steel into the country. And so, that's troubling for him. I talked with some steel workers yesterday when vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine was in Pittsburgh. They find that particularly troubling. Not that they were going to support him in any event, but they think that is an indication of where Hillary Clinton is supporting the workers like them, and that Trump, they feel, is all talk.
I think it's mandatory that in any election race you have to take polls. I don't think you're allowed to talk about campaigns without talking polls. Now, results of some new polls were released this week. Surveys were conducted after the first Trump-Clinton debate among likely voters in a head-to-head matchup. I'm going to give you three polls here. Quinnipiac, Clinton 48%, Trump 43%. So Clinton by 5%. Franklin Marshall, Clinton 47%, Trump 38%. And Monmouth, Clinton 50%, Trump 40%. The advantage for Clinton ranges from 5 percentage points to 10 percentage points. Is that unusual?
Well, I mean, certainly after his performance in the first debate, I think really, I mean, that showed how critical these things can be in a tight race. And he, of course, had a week that was filled with controversial comments and troubling reports. So, you know, I guess in many ways, I'm not surprised by the results. Does that mean that he doesn't have an opportunity to regroup? Of course not. And it, you know, going to Sunday's debate is going to be crucial for him to have a good performance in that. And maybe these numbers start to roll back in his favor.
Yeah, and I'll say this race has been sort of a strikingly volatile one. Back in 2012, we saw much less shifting with the polls with Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, especially after the convention. They were pretty stable for those months leading up to the election. With Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, we don't see that. We see big swings back and forth. You've seen Hillary Clinton getting bumps from these big events, like, you know, the convention gave her a bump, the first debate gave her a sizable bump, and the debate coupled with this last week that Donald Trump has had, I think, you know, it does not look good for him. But again, this is a race where, and I've talked to lots of pollsters in the last couple of weeks, everybody has sort of had their expectations shattered for what they thought was going to happen polls-wise and, you know, with the race in general. So it's very difficult to predict with a lot of certainty, you know, that this is curtains for Donald Trump, that his poll numbers can't recover, because God knows, you know, we've seen lots of things that could have been curtains for Donald Trump but haven't been. So we're definitely looking for more volatility there, and it's going to be interesting to see how the second debate plays out. It's a different format from the first, so it could be, you know, the change that Trump needs to pull off a better performance. I don't think there's any argument that he did not perform that well in the first debate. But yes, we will see how these things affect the polls, but we can expect them to have some impact, it looks like.
It is, and you know, I have a story coming for the weekend that this is going to be a challenging format for him, because the town hall debate format, you know, is about engaging citizens, voters in the audience. And, you know, he vowed this week that he was going to hit her harder, you know, in this second debate, that he took it easy on her in the first one. And, you know, some of the people that I spoke with said, you know, that could be troubling if he goes on the attack in this, where voters will start to feel like maybe, hey, this is supposed to be about us, Mr. Trump, you know. And but, you know, I mean, that's the position that he finds himself in. Again, it's a tight rope for him, because he has to, you know, he has to have a strong performance. But again, he has to really engage these voters at this second debate.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question this next debate is going to be a pivotal one.
I mentioned the Franklin and Marshall poll. The poll director, Terry Madonna, said the decline in support for Trump in Pennsylvania after that last debate reflected several incidents.
The debate performance, the back and forth with a former Miss Universe, some more provocative statements that he made last week, and also the income tax situation. The bottom line is last week was the worst week for Donald Trump since the election began.
So, to both of you, as you mentioned, the words of volatility, big swings, and there's still enough time, including the next debate, for Donald Trump to go back up into the numbers. There is still plenty of time. Would you agree, Katie?
I would agree that there is still time. Obviously, we're getting into the last month here. So, again, in the last few presidential elections, we haven't seen big swings in, again, the last month approaching the election. It sort of, the polls do lock in at a certain point. They become much less volatile. But we haven't seen that this year. Again, we've seen a lot of movement. So I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, if there is that much movement. And I will say with Pennsylvania, what you're looking at with Donald Trump is lots of people have been predicting for a while that there could be a ceiling he's going to hit, right? So you've got the Pennsylvania vote breaks down pretty predictably. The big cities, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, they go blue most of the time. Always. And then the areas in between, they go Republican, with the swing areas or those suburban areas, specifically the Philadelphia suburbs where Trump does not poll well. So, you know, again, you can't say anything for certain, but it does look like he might hit a ceiling.
Tom?
No, I think she hit it right on the head there. I mean, and he has to find a way to at least narrow the gap in the collar counties around Philadelphia and suburban Philadelphia, because right now Hillary Clinton has a very sizable advantage. And, you know, and I talked with Terry Madonna this week as well. I mean, the math just does not work unless he moves those numbers and narrows that gap there. That's a key area for him.
It also kind of, I mean, Donald Trump, we've talked about him changing his message to appeal to moderate voters again and again. He said, oh, he's going to be more on message. He gets a new campaign manager. We expect a tamer Donald Trump. I was at a rally in Lancaster County where we were expecting sort of a tamer on message Donald Trump, but then we got very off message Donald Trump, who called Hillary Clinton crazy. So, I mean, at this point, it's sort of how much can his message change? He's sort of... Trump is who he is. I don't think we're going to see too much radical difference from him.
You mentioned message. Let's talk demographics. What groups are each candidate pursuing? Of course, Donald Trump is going to be in Beaver County this coming Tuesday. His running mate, Mike Pence, was in Johnstown yesterday. Tom, you alluded to Tim Kaine being at CMU yesterday. So whom are the candidates going after? Are they still trying to convince some that might be leaning the other way or traditionally the other way, or are they just trying to solidify their traditional support? Tom?
Well, you know, as I see it for on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, it seems to me, at least based on the appearances she's made here, has really tried to draw more appeal, I guess, with younger voters. I mean, a lot of the younger Democrats who had supported perhaps Bernie Sanders in the primary, there's still that rebuilding effort, trying to build a relationship with them. And for Trump, I mean, it has for him been about, you know, a lot of these disaffected voters, these voters who are disillusioned with politics as usual. And, you know, I mean, he has continually tried to bring those voters in. And you know, I haven't really seen a change in that. I think a lot of people thought he was going to become more, you know, really reach out to some of these more moderate voters with less, you know, with a tamed down version of Donald Trump. But, you know, we haven't seen that.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. I mean, I agree completely. I don't think we have seen Donald Trump effectively reaching out to moderate voters, whether or not that has been his campaign stated strategy. But one of the things that they've been trying to do from the beginning, and there was like a memo that went out early on in the Trump campaign that said that one of their big strategies was going to be turning out low propensity voters, meaning voters who, you know, again, as you said, have been a little bit disillusioned, maybe haven't voted regularly, and that was going to be the Trump voter. One of the, I think, extreme examples of that was that there's an Amish pack in Pennsylvania that's trying to recruit Amish voters. I did a story on that, and I do think it's limited how many Amish are going to turn out. But that is an example of the kind of, again, what a low propensity voter is. Amish don't have great voting numbers. But Trump is looking for some people who just aren't usually courted by political campaigns, and that's a risky strategy. So we will have to see if that pays off in any significant dividends.
I want to get quickly in our last 3 minutes to touch upon the race for the U.S. Senate seat between the incumbent Toomey and the challenger McGuinty. Again, three different polls, very different results. Franklin and Marshall had McGuinty up by 6 percentage points over Toomey. The Monmouth poll had Toomey and McGuinty 46-46, a dead heat. And finally, Quinnipiac had Toomey 50%, McGuinty 42%. That's a 14 percentage point difference from one poll to the other. What's your take on that? Katie, let's start with you.
Sure. So I did a story on this. I think, obviously, this is a big spread, and it reflects two things primarily. One, and sort of, I think, most boringly, is that there are different methodologies that these polls use, so they're never going to be similar. But, that, I mean, that's a huge spread. So one of the other things it reflects is undecided voters. There are a lot of undecided voters in this race. The Senate race has gotten less attention than the presidential race, and as a result, lots of people don't quite know what they're going to do yet. They're still working it out. And so the way that breaks down, and these polls are complicated, so I can't like explain specifically what all the differences are, but one of the things that makes this difference, I'll look specifically at Quinnipiac and FNM, is that Quinnipiac, when they do their polling, they ask which way people are leaning. If somebody's an undecided voter, they ask, okay, but which way do you lean? Do you prefer Toomey or McGuinty? And the way that they came out was with Toomey up 8. FNM doesn't do that. They don't count undecided voters in their final averages, and they don't ask which way people are leaning, and they came out with McGuinty. Now, what this could point to, and again, these are more complicated than I'm making it sound right now, what it could point to is that more undecideds are leaning Toomey. But I think the bigger takeaway that we should have from this, because it's so unsure, is that there are a lot of undecided voters, and this race is going to be very volatile.
Yeah, I think those are all excellent points. I mean, in the FNM poll, I think 22% are undecided. The Monmouth poll has for Katie McGuinty, she has a favorable rating of 27%, 29 unfavorable. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that still don't know what to make of her, and we're getting down to the last month of the campaign. And so, it seems like it's hard to know what to make of this race, and I think we're going to be inundated with ads. There's a ton of money in the race. It's the most outside money that's gone into any Senate race in the country, so you should get used to seeing a lot of ads.
Tom Fontaine is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Katie Meyer is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and other public radio stations in Pennsylvania. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. Now let's check in with our next door neighbor, Ohio, another swing state in this presidential election. ML Schulze is the digital editor and political reporter for Public Radio WKSU. Welcome, Schulze. Good to talk with you.
It's good to talk to you as well.
I have to ask you, Ohio, does it feel like New Hampshire in January of a presidential election year with all of the candidates and some of their top surrogates just flooding into the state, especially recently?
There's a song that has a line in it that says, "How can I miss you if you won't go away?" And honestly, I've been kind of humming that in the back of my head sometimes. There's no question. Ohio's historic standing as a swing state means that no candidate dare ignore it, though there's increasing talk about whether Ohio may be older and whiter and less educated than the nation as a whole and may be losing that bellwether status. Nobody wants to bet on it.
So do the candidates go after traditional strongholds where they would do well, or do they try to chip away where the opponent might be a little stronger?
What you have is Trump is showing up in the Mahoning Valley. That went 2/3 of the voters went for President Obama 4 years ago. He obviously sees it as an area that he can win. He went to a Democratic city up around Cleveland on Labor Day. He's been in Toledo repeatedly. So there's no question that he has staked out areas of the state that have traditionally been ceded to Democrats. The attempted counter to that by the Clinton campaign was to send Bill Clinton on a bus through the Mahoning Valley up into Youngstown and then over to Stark County, which is Canton, Ohio, to try to say, hey, those of you who are feeling anxious about the economy and about your lives and about your communities, I feel your pain. I grew up with an outhouse. It's an attempt to relate to people who feel that overall the Democratic Party is slipping away from them.
The latest Quinnipiac poll I saw shows Trump maintaining his lead in Ohio, 47% to 42%, just outside the margin of error. Has there been any significant changes in Ohio over the last month or so in terms of the polling?
Quinnipiac has shown the widest margin for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton here. A Monmouth University poll came out yesterday and showed that by 2 percentage points, Hillary Clinton is ahead. You can't really compare polls to polls, so you look at the trajectory within polls, and that Monmouth poll, even though it shows Clinton ahead, shows her margin is narrowing. So there's things you look at within each poll, and you look for subsets within each poll.
So how closely, Schulze, should we here in Western Pennsylvania and the nation look at Ohio? I believe the last 13 presidential elections, starting in 64, Ohio has voted for the successful presidential candidate.
And there's no question Donald Trump's road to the White House pretty much has to have Ohio. It's the math doesn't work out any other way. Hillary Clinton, not so much. She's got other calculations that would get her there without Ohio. But again, you don't insult Ohio by saying it doesn't matter. We're just too used to saying, no, we're a bellwether. You've got to pay attention to us. Honestly, I'm looking at you guys. I think Pennsylvania this year may be the true bellwether.
ML Schulze is the digital editor and political reporter for public radio station WKSU covering northeastern Ohio. Schulze, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. It's been good being with you.
Pittsburgh Symphony musicians are on strike for the first time in 40 years. That's ahead on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Members of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra remain on strike and on the picket line, not on the stage in Hines Hall. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra canceled their concerts through October at Hines Hall. The musicians went on strike last Friday, September 30th, almost 41 years to the day to the only other PSO walkout, September 29, 1975. We're going to talk about this dispute with Elizabeth Bloom, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thanks very much for having me.
And joining us by phone is Sarah Ann Hughes, reporter for Pittsburgh's new online news service, The Incline. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. I mentioned how rare such a labor action is, but was it unexpected? Elizabeth, we'll start with you.
Well, I think that there were a few signs that there was something kind of in the works for a long time. Starting this summer, the musicians of the Pittsburgh Symphony had started to mobilize a lot. They purchased T-shirts that were black and gold and said Musicians of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra on them. They started wearing yellow ribbons on their tour in Aspen, Colorado, and at their gala concert. And, you know, certainly everybody kind of knew going in the background that there were negotiations happening. And so I don't think anybody could be totally surprised by the fact that they went on strike. But that being said, it is pretty unprecedented in Pittsburgh. The PSO has long kind of boasted of a favorable or friendly relationship between PSO musicians and management. And I think that the fact that it has gotten to this place could be considered surprising, to be sure.
Sarah?
Elizabeth is totally right. And, you know, it should be pointed out that in the last decade, the musicians have agreed to take salary cuts. They took a 9.7% cut in base salary in 2011, 4.3% a couple of years before that, and 7.8% a couple years before even that. So that the musicians would draw the line on more salary cuts, I wouldn't say it's not surprising, but it may be described as unexpected.
We're used to teacher strikes, walkouts by industrial workers, but a strike by performing artists, does it feel a little bit different?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I will say this. Apparently, one of our photographers said it was the sort of kindest, most calm kind of strike picket line that he had ever encountered. But there have been several such work stoppages in the orchestra industry, basically since the recession. Detroit, the Minnesota Orchestra was locked out. I think Cleveland had one briefly. There have been several across the country. And basically, it's a lot of the same issues that we're seeing here. You know, on the one hand, management says we are going to have to shut our doors if we do not rein in our costs. And musicians say that's simply not true. This is something that you always say. And, you know, oh, by the way, you're going to wreck the artistic product if you erode at the base salary, because we're competing not necessarily with, you know, for musicians in Pittsburgh, but we're competing for musicians internationally, and we need to maintain a healthy salary in order to do that. So this is certainly not new to the orchestra industry, and as surprising as it may seem to sort of see a work stoppage in what could be conceived of as a very white-collar industry, it's definitely not new.
Sarah?
No, absolutely. Philadelphia's orchestra, for example, went on strike around the same time.
The same day.
Rather quickly, and with a newly negotiated contract that will increase the base salary for that orchestra in another 3 years. But, you know, how it's going to resolve in Pittsburgh, if it's going to, you know, end up being that simple here, you know, it's only time will tell.
Yeah. The Philadelphia Orchestra returned less than 48 hours after the strike began.
Mm-hmm. It was very unusual, to be sure, that there were two top 10 orchestras that went on strike on the same day, which was September 30th. The PSO musicians went on strike in the morning. The Philadelphia Orchestra musicians walked out shortly before their gala fundraising concert was to begin. And that is certainly a point of leverage. I mean, those are tend to be big moneymakers for any orchestra, to the extent that there are moneymakers for any orchestra. As I like to say, every orchestra concert is a benefit concert. But they were able to resolve that pretty quickly. Frankly, I have reason to believe that this will not, the Pittsburgh situation will take significantly longer.
Mm-hmm. The two sides seem to be far apart on pay. The last offer from management that we hear is 15% pay cut. Musicians, I believe, offered a pay freeze for year one and then increases of 2, 3, and 4% in the succeeding 3 years. But I understand that there was the, well, if not the original, but a preceding offer or proposal from management was even larger pay cut?
The initial offer from management was to cut pay by 25%. And, you know, certainly that can be shocking, but I think the kind of minutiae of negotiations neither side would be interested in airing, you know, there's a reason that they're called negotiations. You tend to start at the far ends of the spectrum and then eventually move at some point to the middle. The difference this time is that the Pittsburgh Symphony management has stated repeatedly that this is their last, best, and final offer. They cannot move from that 15% base pay cut. Actually, it's a salary cut for all of the musicians. And they cannot move on the other factors, which have to do with the retirement plans and sort of a hiring freeze. And I think the musicians have also stated that they have some wiggle room. But within that wiggle room, I mean, they're extremely far apart. You know, musicians are still asking for raises at the same time that management is still asking for a cut of 15%. I mean, that's an extreme difference of opinion. You know, they're several percentage points away from each other. So I think that is a sort of quantitative matter. But I think the qualitative matter more broadly is, you know, what musicians believe will be an irreversible effect on the quality of the orchestra. Management thinks that this is not actually going to be an issue going forward.
Pensions also an issue, but I want to know if the two sides are closer on this one. A move toward a defined contribution similar to a 401k plan and away from a defined benefit. We spoke with Micah Howard, chair of the Musicians Committee.
We're ready to meet with them. We want to have a fair agreement with management that will ensure the excellence of the institution and also address the financial need.
Address the financial need. Let's start with you, Sarah, on that. Is that another point of a contention? How big is that need?
Sure. I think Elizabeth might be able to speak to the pension part of this a little bit more. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, both sides are using very general language when talking about the pay cuts and the pension at this point. When I was talking to PSO management earlier this week, they kept using the word common ground, the phrase common ground. What exactly that means, what number that is, you know, neither side is really, you know, saying at this point.
So Elizabeth, the pension, do they seem to be maybe a little closer on this one versus the salary issue?
One would actually think that, given that the musicians' last contract proposal, in fact, included a stipulation that would allow the musicians to transition from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan. But actually, I think this is one of the places that they remain extremely far apart. The management is proposing that all of the musicians immediately transition from their pension plan to a defined contribution plan. Now, the pension was frozen for new musicians several years ago, so this would only apply to some of the musicians. But that being said, they are still advocating for this transition with an 8% defined contribution. On the other hand, the musicians have proposed as well a transition to a defined contribution plan, but theirs would not take place until 2019. And it would also include different levels of contributions based on basically seniority in the orchestra. And that is, in their view, to sort of ease the transition between a pension plan and a defined contribution plan for musicians who are pretty close to vesting their pensions and, you know, don't want to be left with nothing once they retire. So that it might seem kind of on paper that they're a little bit closer because they're both thinking about, you know, defined pension, defined benefit plans or defined contribution plans. But in fact, I think they're still pretty far away on that front.
So we're talking numbers and value and percentages and pay cuts and pensions, all kind of numbers. And the overall budget, I believe, is somewhere around $32 million. And but the musicians would like to talk a little bit more about overall value. Jeremy Branson says the musicians are going to hold free concerts throughout the city. He says he and his peers are concerned that administration officials with the symphony orchestra don't value them.
Many of them view us not as craftsmen or as artists of our instruments, but instead as musicians where you can stick a dollar in a vending machine and you get a musician when it comes out. So we are the stewards of this organization at this point, and it's our job to maintain the greatness for the city of Pittsburgh.
So sort of a variation on a question I asked before and to each of you. So is this more than a standard labor strike? Is it sort of a quality of life issue?
Quality of life for Pittsburghers, yes, or quality of life for the musicians?
Well, I guess for both. You take it.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Or their impact on the quality of Pittsburgh's life.
Sure. I mean, the musicians have been very clear in their view that this contract would reduce the quality of the orchestra. Management does not believe that to be true. And we can unpack those statements a little bit. One is that management believes that the salary that they've offered under the last best and final contract is still extremely attractive, and they have very attractive benefits as well. Musicians tend not to compare their salary with the cost of living in Pittsburgh. They tend to compare it with the salaries of other orchestras because you're competing for those musicians. So right now, the base salary of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra as of the 2015-16 season would place them in ninth in the country. The proposed contract cut would get them to about 14th. And what does that mean? I mean, that's, again, we're talking numbers here. Musicians essentially argue that this would transition the orchestra from a destination orchestra, some place where you would sort of plan to spend your entire career, you would become seasoned, you would sort of send these traditions that have been upheld for 120 years down to younger musicians, to a stepping stone orchestra, one where you're here for a few years and then you might take a job elsewhere. And that is basically the gravest concern. Management, for their part, thinks that's just simply not going to happen. Why? Well, it's already extremely difficult to get an orchestra job to start. The PSL already gets hundreds of applicants for any open seat that it has. And so, I mean, it's kind of a he said, she said situation, which is always difficult in these contract talks.
Sarah, as you've covered the story, is that the sense that you're getting from the musicians as well?
Yeah, I think Elizabeth has hit on like a really important point here. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, that is the only full-time orchestra job in Pittsburgh. There are hundreds and hundreds of musicians, professional musicians in the city, but this is the only one where you can get a 52-week contract to play music. But, you know, the musicians have argued that looking at their salary, you know, people who may not be familiar with the salaries of orchestra musicians may think that it seems pretty high. But the musicians I've spoken to, both from the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and who play with other orchestras, say the symphony gives so much more back to the city. That includes with the local universities. A lot of these local musicians teach for Carnegie Mellon or for Duquesne, both schools which have excellent reputations for their music departments. And Micah Howard, who we heard from earlier, was saying that if these cuts happen and some of these teachers who play in the orchestra move to other cities, that means that the quality of Carnegie Mellon, the quality of Duquesne will also suffer, which is not good for the city. I also spoke to Rachel Stegman, who plays in the opera orchestra. And she was talking about some of the benefits that these musicians have, the paid vacation time, the paid sick leave. And she said, you know, to people that may seem like they get a lot of time off, like why, you know, this seems like a great job already with these benefits. But as she pointed out, this is a creative industry. You know, being a musician is not like any other job in the world. And, you know, these musicians work really hard and they need this downtime to recharge, to be, you know, these world caliber musicians that they are.
We have just 1 minute remaining. The musicians have always learned offering free performances starting this weekend to keep, I guess, in front of the eyes of Pittsburghers and in the ears of Pittsburghers. Any talks scheduled that we know of? Could this strike last longer than the one in 75, which I think went 46 days?
If I had to take an over-under on that, I would guess that this strike is going to last longer than 46 days because there are no talks currently scheduled. Concerts have already been canceled through the month of October, so that brings you already to about 30 days. And essentially, they are not agreeing to meet. Management has said that they will not meet with musicians until musicians acknowledge the financial reality that it faces. And, you know, I think that right now you have just basically a pretty intractable situation.
Elizabeth Bloom is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Sarah Ann Hughes is a reporter for the new online news service, The Incline. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
From new budgets for the city and county to a few area students suing their school district, that's all coming up on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A state oversight panel has given a tentative okay to Mayor Peduto's 2017 budget. County Executive Rich Fitzgerald unveils his new spending plan. Some Pittsburgh area students sue their school district over a transgender policy. And floodgates on Washington Boulevard, installed after the death of four people 5 years ago, have failed. The city has a new plan to make them work. We're going to explore each of these with Charlie Deach. He's the editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome back, Charlie. Good to
have you. Thanks for having me back. Nice to be here.
And freelance reporter Kim Lyons, whose work appears in several outlets. Good to have you, Kim.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, let's start with the floodgates on Washington Boulevard. August 19, 2011, a 46-year-old mother, her two daughters, 12 and 8 years old, and a 72-year-old woman drowned when heavy rains triggered roadway flooding 9 feet high, trapping people in their cars. That led to the floodgates being installed. Sometime this summer, the gate's wooden arm was broken, vehicle struck it. Let's face it, mechanical devices fail. They do fail.
Sure.
But isn't one of the issues that these gates apparently had not been inspected for 3 years?
Well, yeah, and you know, the report that was released looking at the problem with the floodgates, they just released a report showing that there were the control switches for the system had been turned to off. And so that's obviously there's some problems with the device itself, but you know, it's obviously you have to, the fight was being over who's going to maintain it, right? Who's responsible for it. And I think that sort of got bogged down in sort of the larger issue. Well, are the actual mechanical pieces working? And it turns out that some of them, it looks like they weren't. So, you know, how do you begin to address that problem?
Right. I mean, the $50,000 that it's going to take to get the system up to snuff is just, I mean, you can find the money anywhere, but well, not anywhere. I'm sure they will find the money, but then it's, are you going to be in the same boat going forward? Or is who, you have to decide whose job that is to take care of that, or else we're going to be back in the same boat 3 years from now.
Well, was there contention about who? Because originally PennDOT had supervision. PennDOT says they turned over supervision to the city in 2013, or is that still a bone of contention? Do we know? Does the city acknowledge?
Yeah, no, I think it is still a bone of contention. That was Luke Ravenstahl, and I don't know when you say they, or when they say they turned it over, I remember at the time they said they put it in, and the mayor said at the time, well, we will take care of it. So then do they go into a room and execute an agreement that, hey, you will take care of this, and if something happens, you're the one on the hook for this? I don't know if that ever happened.
Right.
But
and then while they're having this back and forth, who's going to take care of it, the sort of maintenance of the infrastructure that sort of fell by the wayside. So that's, I think, where you end up with the problem is, you know, you don't have the inspections done. You don't have the equipment up to snuff because we're still arguing over who's going to maintain
right.
it. And even the mayor said when they decided they're going to pledge us $50,000 to get the system repaired, you know, he said it's just a Band-Aid. When you look at all the sort of larger infrastructure problems that lead to these kinds of concerns, I mean, flooding in this area is obviously a huge concern anytime it rains.
Is that still being studied? Because there are some major proposals, or at least some ideas that are being floating out there, everything from a retention pond, so the water, the heavy rainwater can at least go in somewhere right. and not on the roadways and flood the roadways, to even adjusting the height of the roadway itself. Are those still being floated out there?
Well, it looks like the city has a checklist, you know, that's in place. But it's a matter of figuring out when they can do what, you know, and how frequently they have to do things. But, you know, there's so many things to try and tackle but this is such an immediate one that obviously there was a tragedy. And so it's very visible. And I think that's why it's gotten so much attention.
Yeah. And they call it a Band-Aid, but a Band-Aid only works if it actually works, if it actually stops the bleeding. And in this last case, it didn't stop the bleeding. And, you know, so I think they really need to step it up and move quicker toward a final resolution than just, I mean, yes, fix the system now, but I think they need to move quicker toward a final resolution.
Okay. This week, the Intergovernmental Cooperation Authority, one of the state oversight panels, gave conditional approval to Mayor Peduto's proposed budget for next year of $539.4 million. What's the condition? It has to do with you have to prove you can get $10 million in gaming funds?
Right. After the state law that said you have to pay $10 million was ruled unfair and uncollectible, the city's now forced to go to Rivers Casino, and then cities all across the state have to go to their casinos and say, hey, look, I know you don't have to pay this, but maybe you'd like to, you know, continue the relationship. You know, we're sending your blackjack players and slot players. Let's return the favor a little bit. And who knows?
The city has tried those pilots, as they're known as, payment in lieu of taxes in the past, and just general support. So is that just wishful thinking or what?
Well, I think the second that entities didn't have to pay pilot payments, they didn't pay pilot payments. So maybe the casinos are different. Maybe they have a heart of gold we don't know about, but I don't know.
Is this ironic? I have to ask you that the condition is based on you have to prove you can get $10 million in gaming revenues. Right. When last year around this time, the city and the ICA were fighting over ICA withholding gaming revenues.
Yes. Yeah. The ICA. Yeah. It's funny how gaming revenue keeps coming up with the ICA. And I think is a fair solution is I think that the Rivers should give the city $5 million. But they have to place it on one hand a blackjack. And if they hit...
Double or nothing.
Yeah, well, and if they hit a blackjack, they get 6-5. So it's, you know, it's good to pick. It's good pay.
Roll the dice, literally.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what it is. It really is. It's a crapshoot. I mean, are they going to pay if they don't have to? And, you know, I don't know. They could.
County Executive Rich Fitzgerald delivered his $880 million budget for next year to council this week, up 3% from this year, no property tax increase. Anything stand out in that spending plan to either of you two?
Well, I think the no property tax increase is one that everyone's sort of breathing a sigh of relief over. Those of us who live in Allegheny County, that's fairly remarkable. I think for the most part, was that expected? I have to be honest, I haven't kept as up to snuff.
I don't cover. We have a writer, other writer who covers county, but yeah, I think that's always been the plan. I don't think that there was a tax increase was expected.
Yeah.
So I think it, you know, I think one thing, and Fitzgerald gets a lot of grief for some things. He has been able to hold the line on taxes. He's been able to get his budgets in and get his budgets through. Part of that, of course, some people would say is because county council doesn't put up much of an argument or a fight over that.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't have the relationship with county council that Peduto sometimes has with city council,
correct,
where there's some, you know, a lot of headbutting that goes on for the sake of headbutting,
right,
you know, a lot
but
of the
Rich
time.
But Fitzgerald's been able to do this because has not had to raise property taxes, the rates of taxes, because values have gone up. So he's able to increase the overall spending plan.
Yeah. Without actually having to turn the
raise
screws.
Raise the taxes, though people are paying more in taxes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Three transgender students in Pine Ridge School District filed a federal discrimination lawsuit Thursday over the district's restroom policy. This is the first time in Pennsylvania for a school district to be sued over this issue.
Yeah,
and you know, the school district probably should have seen that this was coming. I mean, there was a policy that the board voted 5-4 on September 12th to establish this policy limiting transgender students which restrooms they could use. Before they did this, the transgender students who spoke up and filed this lawsuit said, we weren't having any problems. We had the sort of usual strange look sometimes that unfortunately transgender students will get, but they created this whole new issue for these students. So
they actually, in a sort of rescinded their old policy.
Right, that was in place and that was, you know, not causing any problems, not doing, you know, the students seemed to be handling it fine. And then they created this policy and now these students are saying, well, wait a second, you know, this is not how it should be.
Yeah, and they were widely praised for not at first not bowing to public pressure to put a policy in place or to rescind their policy. And, you know, they stood up and they, you know, stood with their students to try and make the most comfortable situation they could. And then here we are a few months later, and they're, again, they finally caved to that pressure by one vote. And it's just, I don't know, it's really kind of a backward plan when we have people who, we have districts who are going out of their way, like the Pittsburgh Public Schools are going out of their way to welcome right. transgender students, make them feel safe, make them feel comfortable. And then Pine Richland is doing this. It's just, it's not forward thinking, and it's kowtowing to public pressure.
Well, some of these cases are going to wind up in court because you have this lawsuit. You have, of course, I believe 13 states challenging the Obama directive regarding this issue. And then you have a couple of U.S. district courts, I believe in Ohio and Wisconsin, that put preliminary injunctions blocking school districts from putting these kind of restrictions on students. Finally, the final item I want to get to is a story that you were reporting on, Kim, that you followed closely, and that was the 10th anniversary of 311.
Yeah.
So what was its intention? Has it been meeting its goals?
It's interesting how it's evolved over the years. You know, it kind of started out as a, you know, central place to get help or get information, and it evolved into a lot of different things. You know, they kind of came into their own during the Stormageddon storm several years ago, where they were decided, look, we can't really just do this 8 to 4. We have to open this up 24 hours. But it really turned into sort of a one-stop shop for people who needed information about the city. You know, when does something close? They've done a lot of to integrate other departments, not just city departments, but other agencies that the city works with to say, okay, we can get Pittsburgh Water and Sewer out to you. We can get directly connected to them. And so it's interesting how it's gone from just sort of being this central, you know, question and answer to being sort of the place where you begin to find information about the city. And the staff there really, you know, I was surprised to hear some of the stories that they hear from people and the ways they try to help people connect with, you know, there was a letter in a bottle, and so they were trying to figure out, where did this come from? It came from Pittsburgh. And so they kind of went out of their way to try and find the information. They weren't successful in that case. But, you know, they feel a sense of, you know, responsibility to try and get as many questions answered, even if they're a little bit off the wall, which was sort of interesting.
Charlie, Kim did the story for Pittsburgh City Paper. Why were you interested in this 10th anniversary of a 311 system?
Yeah, I think we've all sort of heard, you know, we all sort of have an idea of what 311 is. But, you know, I was curious about, well, it's been around 10 years. You know, is it still the sort of analog system it used to be? How have they updated? How have they grown? And then also just... Are they actually doing the job? Are they actually getting out there and filling potholes? And turns out they're not only doing that, they're doing a whole lot more that goes above and beyond. It's kind of nice to see a city entity, you know, really going out of their way. And I think that the department has really, they've really worked hard to make sure that they're a public service. And I think that's a very good thing.
Yeah.
Kim, 30 seconds. Any plans for improvements or enhancements to the system?
I think they're always looking at that. They're always looking at what can we do better. I mean, they recently started taking requests on Twitter, which I think has been a big success, especially for people who ride bikes and potholes. So they're always looking for ways to improve the system and be better customer service central for the city.
Kim Lyons is a freelance reporter whose work appears in many publications. Charlie Deitch is the editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And now, what's ahead? Many pundits have called it an election like none other. This year's presidential contest, Tuesday's October 11th, is the deadline to register to vote in Pennsylvania. You can register in person in the Allegheny County Elections Division, at other sites, including PennDOT license centers, or how 500,000 Pennsylvanians have done it in the past year, online at Everyone Votes PA. You can find all the ways to register at our website, wesa.fm. This week, that's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Studio producer today, Katie Blackley. Production assistance from Vince Bellastrino. The producer of the program is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.